From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, protesters greeted President Trump with chants of vote him out as he paid his respects to the late Justice Ginsburg at the Supreme Court. Trump's push to fill her vacancy despite her dying wishes to wait has set off a partisan firestorm, and he threw kindling on that fire yesterday by not committing to a peaceful transfer of power after the election. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson starts us off. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Robin.
So, Mara, let's set the scene. A reporter at a White House briefing asked Trump if he could commit to a peaceful transfer of power. He said, "We'll have to see. The ballots are a disaster." The reporter asked again, and here's what President Trump said.
"Get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation."
Now, the president seemed to be referring there to mail-in ballots that he falsely claims will be fraudulent. There's been practically no fraud with ballots. The Biden campaign responded by saying the American people will decide this election and the United States government is perfectly capable of escorting trespassers out of the White House. Remind us what they mean.
What Biden is talking about is if Trump is the clear loser, he will not be able to stay in the White House even if he doesn't concede. That's a simple scenario, but it's not the one that most people are worried about. The big question is, what if it's close? Trump seems to be assuming a close election where he possibly could be leading on election night and a long drawn out process with a lot of irregularities as mail-in ballots are counted over the ensuing days and weeks. This is called the red mirage, where Trump would be leading in in-person ballots on election night, and then it turns into the blue shift, where Biden starts picking up the lead as the mail-in ballots are counted. This is exactly what happened in the 2018 congressional elections. Trump, I think, is getting ready to say that any ballot that isn't counted on election day is fraudulent, and he's going to move to create a lot of confusion, challenging ballots. And for two reasons. Obviously, he wants to hold on to power, but also he can't go out of office being a loser. That's totally against his brand. He has to be able to create the biggest conspiracy theory ever if he loses, which is that he was robbed. He's the rightful president.
And election officials are saying the count may take longer this year, but there's always ballots counted after election day. Do we have a sense of when? You know, the count could be completed.
Well, it could take weeks. I mean, it really depends. Now, the important thing to remember is Florida and Ohio, those are two pretty big, important states, they actually count their absentee ballots first. So Florida is not one of those states that's going to be taking weeks and weeks to count. There are other battleground states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, that do take longer. So I guess everybody who hopes for a proper future for American democracy should be hoping that we have a clear result on election night, one way or the other.
We know the Republican Senator Mitt Romney called out the president on Twitter, saying any suggestion that a president might not respect this constitutional guarantee of a peaceful transfer is unthinkable and unacceptable. But Mitt Romney is sort of sidelined in his own party. Have any other Republicans said anything about the president's
threat? Yes, absolutely. Liz Cheney, part of the House Republican leadership, has said there will be a peaceful transfer of power. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Rob Portman, Ben Sasse, there have been a lot of Republicans who have said, yes, there will be a peaceful transfer of power. However, this is an extraordinary thing. In the United States of America, we actually have to get assurances from Congress that there will be a peaceful transfer of power because the president himself will not commit to that. That's just stunning.
That's the bedrock of a democracy. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Minutes after the grand jury announcement that no charges would be filed against two of the Louisville police officers involved in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor, people took to the streets in places like New York, Denver, and Portland. Here's Portland, Oregon last night.
Breonna Taylor!
6 months ago, Taylor was in her apartment when police broke through the door for what they said was a late-night drug raid. Her boyfriend opened fire, saying he believed there were intruders. Police fired at least 30 shots into that apartment, which authorities say was justified because they had been fired upon. The only charges in this case are against one of those officers whose shots went into another apartment. This outcome, for many, is another example of the pervasive injustices in our country. Ibram Kendi is an author and historian and founding director of Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. Ibram Kendi, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Doctor, yesterday when the announcement came down, you went on Twitter and you wrote this, quote, "To not indict the officers for murder is to claim Breonna Taylor killed herself. Racist America constantly kills Black people and then tells Black people we killed ourselves. Racism extends past death." Say more.
So you just have so many Black people who've been killed by the police, who've been killed by COVID-19, who've been killed by vigilantes. And then when it comes to bringing them justice by declaring that they were not in the wrong, you know, justice is always lacking. Justice in the sense of indicting the people who actually killed them, or even indicting our society's racist policies and seeking to change them. But instead, Black people were always typically blamed for our own deaths.
As we know, Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who is on President Trump's short list as a potential Supreme Court nominee, stated in his remarks yesterday that the shooting was justified. And that word justified is really sitting with people because it sounds so contrary to the facts that we have publicly seen. Now there is a call for all of the evidence to be made public. Would you like to see that?
Oh, without question. So we can assess for ourselves. So we can assess whether the Kentucky Attorney General made a political decision to not indict the officers because it would be better for his own personal political career. Or in fact, there was evidence somehow justifying Breonna Taylor's death. All of the public evidence that we know of does not justify her death. And so that's the thing. If you're claiming it's justified, then show us the evidence.
Since March, Louisville has banned no-knock warrants. One officer, the one charged with wanton endangerment, has been fired. So has the police chief. But this highlights a bigger issue, that police officers are rarely charged or convicted. The bigger call is for police reform, but there is such a huge percentage of Americans who actually don't want to see reform. They believe that police are doing an effective job, and there really seems to be very little in between or meeting of the minds on this. It's a line in the sand. You are an anti-racist scholar. Do you see a future where we can come together and what we all wish for, and that's a system of anti-racist policing?
I mean, that's the goal. That's the hope. But I think in order to reimagine public safety, we're going to have to reimagine violence and danger. And in that reimagining of violence and danger, we cannot be connecting violence and danger and criminality to the color of one's skin. That is indeed a racist idea, to connect danger and violence and criminality to Black people and then state that it makes sense. Officers are justified in fearing for their lives when they shoot and kill unarmed Black people, or when they barge into someone's home late at night and those people thinking that they're a robber, they seek to defend themselves. Because of racist ideas, it is imagined that Black people do not have the right to defend themselves, particularly in the face of white police officers. And that's wrong. I mean, we need to completely reimagine the way we understand justice, self-defense, and certainly who's dangerous and what's dangerous. Because for me, our system, our criminal justice system is dangerous, not Black people.
You wrote last night, "To be Black in America is to walk in the valley of the shadow of pain and death. The fact that Black people still manage to carry on and create and find joy and love in the valley is nothing short of a miracle. And right now, our love of Breonna Taylor is filling us with rage." Dr. Kendi, where does that rage go from here?
It goes from here, first and foremost, of course, to mourn yet again. You know, we not only have mourned her death, now we're mourning the fact that her killers are not going to be brought to justice. But then that mourning transforms into seeking to transform our society, into seeking to transform American policing, in seeking to transform our criminal justice system, into seeking to disconnect blackness from criminality, into seeking to protect black women, to protect every single American from police violence. And that's where we need to be focused on, in changing power and policy to ensure that happens.
Dr. Ibram Kendi is an author and historian and founding director of Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. Professor Kendi, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
As the election approaches, we've been looking at the candidates' policies and proposals. Today, healthcare, which has taken on a new urgency since the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The court is expected to issue a ruling on whether the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is legal and take that up as soon as November 10th. The president, of course, wants to overturn the ACA, which insures about 20 million Americans and prevents insurers from denying coverage for pre-existing conditions. Here's the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden.
Insurers could once again discriminate or deny services or drop coverage for people living with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, cancer, and so much more. Perhaps most cruelly of all, if Donald Trump has his way, those who have complications from COVID-19 could become the new pre-existing conditions.
But Vice President Pence said this week Americans needn't worry about that.
The president will be taking some action under his executive branch authority to make it clear to every American that those that are facing pre-existing conditions will be covered under insurance plans. They will not be denied coverage.
Can the president get pre-existing conditions covered with an executive order? And where is the rest of his plan? It's been promised for years. And what about Medicaid, reproductive health, something a 6-3 conservative court is also expected to overturn as Roe v. Wade? What about the coronavirus? Health policy is always important. It's really important this year. Let's bring in Larry Levitt. He's executive vice president for health policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Larry, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And let's start with the ACA, Obamacare. It's interesting. Polls show that people really, really don't want their ACA taken away, but some of them don't understand that that is Obamacare. President Trump filed a suit in June saying that because part of the ACA was ruled illegal, this is the mandate that Americans have insurance and subsequent fines if they don't, the president says the rest should go too if the mandate is gone. But that mandate is what pays for people with pre-existing conditions. You know, the more people who are on board, especially healthy people, the more we can afford. Can the president, as Pence says, force insurers to cover pre-existing conditions without the framework of the ACA?
I don't see a way that the president can just wave a magic wand and protect people with pre-existing conditions. An executive order can't just out of thin air create authority for the president. That authority has to somewhere exist in law. And there is ample authority in the Affordable Care Act to protect people with pre-existing conditions, as it's done for many years. But if the court overturns the Affordable Care Act, then I don't see how the president could fulfill his promise to protect people with pre-existing conditions without going back to Congress and passing a new law.
Well, this is in part because we don't see a plan. And this is going to, this is what makes this conversation difficult, because I don't think we've ever had a president or a candidate this close to an election without a plan. There isn't one on his website. And I don't mean to be flip, but, the plan seems to be fill the Supreme Court with a candidate who will overturn the ACA and Roe v. Wade, which we'll get to. Do you expect a plan? It's being promised.
I mean, the president has promised a plan on multiple occasions, as you've said, and we have yet to see it. This is not the norm. Presidential candidates always have 5-point plans, 10-point plans for all kinds of issues, and in particular healthcare. But we have not seen that from the president. And I think what you then have to rely on is his record. He is supporting this lawsuit before the Supreme Court to overturn the ACA, including protections for people with pre-existing conditions. He has expanded short-term insurance plans that don't follow the ACA's rules and therefore don't cover people with pre-existing conditions. And he supported efforts in 2017 to overturn the ACA in Congress, which was a big part of his platform in 2016. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Joe Biden on the ACA. He was vice president when it was enacted. He, along with many Democrats, say they know it's flawed and he wants adjustments, including a Medicare-like public option that would cover lower-income people in states that didn't expand Medicaid. Now, tell us more. This isn't Medicare for all.
This is not Medicare for all. This is, in some sense, what Pete Buttigieg talked about during the campaign, which is Medicare for all who want it. So the idea is a Medicare-like plan that would automatically cover low-income people who states have chosen not to cover in Medicaid, and would also be available to anyone. So someone in an employer plan, which is how most people get coverage, if the deductible's too high, the premium's too high, and they can't afford it, they could instead switch to this Medicare-like public option.
Yeah. Let's move on to reproductive health. The president has said he wants to overturn Roe v. Wade, which allows women to choose a legal abortion. He's also taken fairly restrictive measures during his presidency, prohibiting federal family planning funds to clinics that also provide abortions, excluding ACA contraceptive coverage for employees of businesses. The businesses might have moral or religious objections. There's already been an exclusion for religious organizations. This is just for businesses who just object. So, first of all, how critical, again, is that empty seat for healthcare, or what some would call reproductive health?
Yeah, I think, this Supreme Court fight has big implications for the ACA, as we've been talking about. It has potentially even more far-reaching implications for access to reproductive health and in particular, abortion. We've seen a number of cases before the Supreme Court over the last several years around state efforts to restrict abortion, the Trump administration efforts to restrict access to contraceptive coverage. And I expect we will see many more of those cases, particularly as the court, and assuming that the court does tilt more conservative.
Right. Well, and what about Joe Biden's plans on reproductive health? He obviously supports Roe v. Wade, but there may not be a Roe v. Wade for him to support. Has he talked about how you could possibly make up for that? I mean, he has promised coverage for family planning, contraception, anti-discrimination rules for the gay community, the gay and lesbian community. But, what can he do?
Joe Biden's agenda on reproductive health is pretty much the polar opposite of President Trump's agenda. I mean, he wants to reverse the restrictions on federal family planning funding. And that's certainly something he could do independent of the Supreme Court. He does support Roe v. Wade, supports nominating judges who will uphold abortion rights, but that may be a harder hill to climb after this current confirmation battle.
Well, but we don't really talk that much about politics in these issue segments, but in this case we have to. If the president gets his nominee, which seems pretty likely, but loses the election and senators do as well, can a President Joe Biden and more Democratic senators simply pass another Roe v. Wade?
It is certainly possible to legislate a right to abortion. The legal cases over Roe v. Wade revolve around whether there is a constitutional right. But there can certainly be a legal right created by Congress and the president. And I would expect, if Democrats do sweep the election, an effort to pursue that. And then, of course, it would be up to states as well. If Roe v. Wade were overturned, the right to abortion would not go away everywhere. It would potentially go away in a number of states, but other states would move to preserve that right.
Okay. Drug prices. The candidates actually agree that the prices are out of control. What has President Trump done about that?
This is an area where President Trump has talked a lot. I mean, he has spent a good bit of his presidency talking about bringing drug prices down. He just has not accomplished very much in that area. He has made another number of proposals and then pulled those proposals back. He recently issued a couple executive orders around prescription drug prices and has supported the idea that certain drug prices in the Medicare program for seniors and people who are disabled should match the prices that are paid in other countries.
Yeah. And where does Joe Biden stand?
Joe Biden has a much more sweeping plan. He wants the federal government to be able to negotiate drug prices. Not just for federal programs like Medicare, but for everyone. So if you're uninsured, if you have private insurance, the federal government would negotiate the price. And that's much more similar to what other countries do. And the fact that the federal government can't negotiate or set the prices now is why we pay so much higher prices than the rest of the world.
Well, and we've got about a minute left here. Oh, we're in a pandemic. We're doing a health policy. I mean, this is also just pretty, it's just kind of wild that we're in a pandemic and we have one candidate, a president who, you know, we know now withheld information about the severity, has been hostile towards the prevention, which is masks, holding indoor rallies. And you have Joe Biden who says he'll put scientists and public health leaders front and center. We don't really have to, you know, try to dig deep to find where the stands are on this issue. They're right there.
No, I mean, there will be many consequential decisions that the next president makes. But I think the really big divide here is over the kind of leadership that President Trump has exercised and the role of science. I mean, I think so much has revolved around that, whether it's whether masks are effective, how a vaccine should be approved, getting testing out there.
Yep.
And, you know, the candidates have a very different approach.
We are voting on that as well. Larry Levitt, Kaiser Family Foundation, thank you so much.
California is moving to end sales of new gas-powered cars and trucks by 2035 in an aggressive move to combat climate change. Governor Gavin Newsom told reporters yesterday the ban will cut greenhouse gas emissions by 35% in the state.
In the next 15 years, we will eliminate in the state of California the sales of internal combustion engines. We will move forward to green and decarbonize our vehicle fleet here in the state of California. As a consequence, substantially reducing greenhouse gas emissions as well as oxide nitrogen, meaning NOx emissions here in the state of California.
The executive order does not ban people from owning gas-powered cars or selling them on the used car market. And for more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
So California's order also sets a goal for all heavy-duty trucks to be zero emissions by 2045 where possible. How exactly would this work?
Well, so there's a state agency called the California Air Resources Board, and they have been tasked to actually write out the exact regulations about how it will work. So there are still some open questions, for example, about whether the sale of plug-in hybrids will be allowed. But as you mentioned at the beginning, this is aimed at new car dealerships, basically saying they'll be forbidden from selling new vehicles with internal combustion engines. Used vehicle sales will still actually be allowed, but it's that new car dealership market that this is targeting.
Stepping back here, transportation is the state's biggest and rising source of emissions, but the Trump administration has sought to block California's authority to mandate zero emission vehicles. Are other states expected to follow California's lead?
So California does tend to be sort of a trendsetter when it comes to environmental issues like this, at least for states where the governors and the legislative majorities take the environment and climate issues more seriously. In this case, I think a lot depends on who wins the presidential election. As you pointed out, the current administration has been very vocal in opposing some previous efforts by California to boost regular combustion engine car fuel efficiencies. Whereas the Joe Biden platform includes a plan to get the economy to a net zero emissions by no later than 2050. So my guess is that some states will wait to see how the presidential election shapes up, because there could be some friction if they do try to follow California's lead in an administration that does not agree with that.
I'm thinking about the oil industry. What impact could this have on them, and have they responded to this?
Yeah, so California is one of the biggest gasoline markets in the world, and not surprisingly, they're not very happy about this. There are some spokespeople for various energy industry groups quoted in the New York Times and quoted on NPR, basically talking about how this could be a job killer in the energy industry. Another representative for the Institute for Energy Research told NPR, you know, driving cars is not what causes forest fires. If people want to drive these electric cars, they can buy them. You have to eliminate the you don't have to eliminate the competition.
A lot here, for sure.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So there is certainly some pushback from the energy industry.
Bloomberg News senior editor Mike Regan, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Contact tracing is vital in helping to stop the spread of the coronavirus, but officials at health departments nationwide say the process is being delayed by poor communication between labs and testing sites, and by people not wanting to share information about who they've been around. Anna Huntsman from member station WCPN has the story from Northeast Ohio.
Hi, my name is Dr. Egwekor. I'm calling from the Cuyahoga.
Amina Egwekor, a physician and contact tracer, is calling people who tested positive for COVID-19 from the county's health department offices near Cleveland.
One, I just wanted to make sure, are you aware of your test results for COVID? Okay.
This is just one of the many case calls she's made since the pandemic began back in March. She asks the patient how she's been feeling and writes down her symptoms on an information packet.
And do you remember when all of this kind of started, what day that was? Oh, so all three of you guys tested positive. Gotcha. Okay.
She learns the patient started feeling sick after going out to dinner with a friend. That friend later tested positive, and after a few days, the patient, her husband, and daughter all tested positive. Even though this all happened in mid-July, Egwekor called for the first time in mid-August, almost a month later. That's because the health department didn't have all the information it needed to get in touch with the patient until then.
Either it's because the system did not upload it, or sometimes there's missing information, so it takes a while. So once we get that missing information, then we can give them a call. So like sometimes what we'll get is maybe a name, and then we have to reach back out and say, okay, what's their address? Do you have a contact phone number? Things like that. So sometimes information may be missing.
Egwekor says when they receive incomplete information from testing sites, it holds up the contact tracing process because they're not able to talk to people who have confirmed cases right away. Ramona Brazil, who's in charge of the Cuyahoga County's contact tracers, says another issue is that some testing labs weren't reporting results to the health department in the first place.
They may send those results by emails, or we may find out, hey, there's a lab that's doing this testing and they're not reporting. You know, so there's a literally test results that we're unaware of. And so like getting that lab to still submit us the test results is part of our challenge.
In nearby Medina County, Health Commissioner Krista Wasowski says some testing locations were only collecting email addresses from people, which is not health officials' preferred way to reach out.
The lag time in being able to contact someone does reduce the effectiveness of contact tracing and the ability to quickly get in touch with someone who may have been exposed.
Other states across the country are encountering these challenges as well. Some report difficulty keeping up with calls due to testing delays and not having enough tracers. In some cases, people have refused to tell tracers whom they have been in contact with. Cuyahoga County Director Ramona Brazil says their tracers occasionally struggle with getting information from people because the pandemic has become a heated political topic.
People who may think we have kind of an agenda, people who don't believe it, they think it's a hoax, they hang up on us, they cuss at us. So our contact tracers have really had to absorb a lot of that in trying to do their job.
All right. Well, it was great speaking with you. I hope you feel better. Thank you. You take care.
Dr. Egwekor with the Cuyahoga County Health Board says even if a contact tracing call has been delayed, most people know by now that they need to quarantine, which was the case with the person she just called. But her quarantine period was almost up by the time Egwekor was able to contact her. She says people can do their part in helping to mitigate these delays by giving testing locations as much information as possible and isolating as soon as they start having symptoms.
Yeah, it's a whole network, so we're all working together to kind of help with, you know, mitigating and preventing the spread.
Another delay in the process is that contact tracers still write down information on a paper packet, and some information is sent through fax. Brazil says the health board is moving to a system where the information contact tracers collect will be computerized to speed up getting information to people about who has the virus. Other health departments are looking to other technology, such as specially designed apps, to try to expedite the contact tracing process. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Huntsman in Cleveland.
Well, more than 200,000 people in the U.S. have died of COVID-19 to date. And as we come to terms with that grim number, we want to reflect on the lives lost. One of them is that of Richard Proya. He was an accountant from Rochester, New York, and died of the virus in April at the age of 66. And to remember him, we have his daughter with us, Angelina. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Angelina, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I want to thank you so much
for
being willing to share your story with us. How are you and your family?
We're devastated. We're trying to cope as best we can, especially given the tenor of the country. I think it makes it harder. The grief process has been harder because of the restrictions placed on us. So I think everything is like grief amplified.
I understand that your dad started feeling sick at the beginning of April. Tell us what happened.
So he started to get sick April 1st. He had a urinary tract infection. And he didn't know it was COVID. He just thought it was a UTI. And the CDC told us that that was the first bit of information they had that led them to believe that he had it as early as April 1st with the UTI. So April 3rd rolls around, and he's beginning to feel lethargic. So he goes to the hospital, and they send him back home without testing him. And that's because he has no fever and he can breathe. His O2 is good. So he went back home, and Monday they found him delirious in his apartment. He had a 103-degree fever, and he went to the hospital and they put him on a ventilator, and he never came off. And he was on a ventilator for 10 days. And he died on April 16th. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about your father. What are some of your fondest memories of him?
I'm sorry. We loved to go to Coney Island, and he would get in the slingshot. And he this must have been like, you know, 6 years ago. So he was in his 60s by then, and he didn't care. Even when he was sad, he had a smile on his face. And it infected you. I mean, you wanted to be mad at him, but you couldn't be because he was just so happy. And that was my dad. He would want to see that we were all taken care of. He was generous, and he was kind, and he was extremely gentle. And he didn't deserve to die that way.
Has your family been able to have a memorial service or a funeral or any of those traditional ways that we all grieve together?
We did not have that opportunity. We couldn't have a funeral that was limited to 10 people. He was cremated, so we weren't able to have like a wake or anything like that. So no, we didn't get to grieve normally.
You have started this Facebook group called COVID-19 Loss Support for Family and Friends, because you say there just weren't any resources that you could find to help you and others like you who have lost loved ones to COVID. And there is clearly a need, because you have more than 2,000 members now part of this group. It's a collective grieving space and an acknowledgement.
Yeah, I mean, because the grieving process is so unique, and we can really understand that, those nuanced things that happen when someone dies of COVID, like the isolated grief process. That's something that we understand in that group. We also understand how it feels to have people say that it's not real, like it makes grieving harder. We also share a collective anger with officials who are responsible for mitigating things like this.
Absolutely. You know, I asked you what your fondest memories are of your father, but it struck me in you telling me about the inability of your family to even get together to grieve and have a traditional funeral. Would you like to use this opportunity to tell the world what you want them to remember about your father?
My father was kind and gentle and good, and he deserves to be recognized. And I just want the world to know that he's more than just a number. He's not one more tally on the 200,000. He's my dad. And he is missed deeply.
Angelina, thank you for sharing a little bit of your dad with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting me share my father.
Angelina Broya of New York City speaking with us about her father, Richard Broya, one of the more than 200,000 people who have died of COVID-19. My best to you and your family, Angelina.
Thank you.
Gillian Flynn is the hugely successful author of thrillers like Gone Girl, The Story of a Missing Wife and the Husband Who Might Have Killed Her, and Sharp Objects, in which a reporter with a habit of self-cutting finds a story too close to home. When the first became a hit movie and the second an Emmy-nominated TV series, Gillian was involved in the process of going from page to screen. Now she's in charge as creator and showrunner-writer of the new Amazon series Utopia. This features a world even darker than those in her books. It centers around a graphic novel, Dystopia, and its cult fan following.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Jessica Hyde. Jessica Hyde had a daddy who was a genius scientist. Now Jessica and her daddy were held by an evil villain named Mr. Rabbit. He made Daddy Hyde create horrible viruses.
Oh, how timely. Viruses. In the series, a few fans of the book suspect the world it portrays might be real. Then the sequel to Dystopia, Utopia, is discovered. Suddenly, a wacky comic convention, everyone in costumes, becomes a killing field. Assassins eliminate anyone who's seen even a page of Utopia. Oh, and that character, Jessica Hyde, she exists. Utopia premieres tomorrow on Amazon, and Gillian Flynn joins us by Skype. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Okay, I just have to at the outset say, I'm like a Masterpiece Theater kind of gal. I was lucky to see, you know, some of the first episodes. Man, this is dark.
It is a bit dark. I think people would be surprised to hear if I had written a romantic comedy or anything like that, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, and you say, you know, when it comes to all your work, you have friends who love you but just can't see it.
You know, yes, I have large swaths of friends who have never read or seen anything I've done because they just aren't not into thrillers. They don't like to be scared. And I always say that is absolutely fine. I don't come to your office and sit and watch you do accounting or anything like that. So I do not take it personally.
And meanwhile, you're also thinking, you poor thing, you're an accountant and I get to go into this world. I mean, talk about going into this world. You sound like a very normal, happy person. You know, what's that like being immersed in these worlds?
You know, I love it. I don't know if I'm able to exercise my demons through writing about the darker side, but I certainly have always been someone who is interested in the darker side of human nature. And I've always loved a good scare. And I think the world can be divided into people who like to look under the rock and people who don't. And I've always been the person who has said, you know, let's flip over the rock.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another scene. A group of fans who've seen this book, Utopia, they're, you know, running away from the assassins and they're rescued by a woman who tells them she is Jessica Hyde. She's tough. Let's listen.
I am only willing to help you if you are useful to me. If you cry, if you whine, if you complain, if you challenge me, I will cut you loose and let you die.
She's after one thing, which is to find her father, who's been kidnapped, and that will hold the secrets to why people are after her, what she's supposed to do. To me, she's sort of a kind of statement about where we all are existentially, which are those questions of, why am I here? What am I supposed to do? What's my meaning? What's my purpose?
Well, your purpose, Gillian Flynn, seems to be to tell these difficult-to-tell stories. You say you're not about to go and write a romance. Never?
You know, I don't know that I would be good at that, to tell you the truth. I think, you know your limitations. I love writing mysteries and I love writing thrillers because to me, they're a great way to talk about bigger themes, you know, and with Gone Girl, for instance, I wanted to talk about marriage and gender roles, and Sharp Objects, I wanted to talk about what female violence looked like, especially cyclically and generationally. And that was when I first realized, after I'd written 100 pages of people sitting around and talking in rooms in a very not interesting way, that if I could tie it to a mystery, that would give me that engine to pull it through. And what I like about that is it gives a means and a vocabulary for people to talk about these bigger issues without feeling like homework. I've never felt like it was bad to be entertaining. I mean, I never have set out to be the book that sits on your nightstand waiting to be read because you know you should and you know you respect it, or sits on your DVR piling up episode after episode and you know I know I should watch this. I really like being a page turner or a cliffhanger, but still being able to sneak in those larger themes that I like. And people, if they just want to have a good thriller, you can just engage on that level. But if you find some interesting themes, then you can have more to talk about. Yeah.
That's Gillian Flynn, creator and showrunner of the new Amazon series, Utopia. Gillian, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Utopia premieres tomorrow on Amazon. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.